This is Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. Political journalism is an extraordinarily polarizing field, even and maybe especially among people who are not in the industry. You definitely have feelings about how the news covers elections. Broadly, Americans are suspicious of the mainstream media, and election years shine a spotlight on our best and, frankly, worst practices. You've probably heard the term horse race journalism, the practice of focusing on polls, momentum, campaigning, who's winning. It's not about policy and substance. The question is, as we evaluate the role of the Fourth Estate in 2024, do people even want to hear about policies? Or is there a role for the horse race?
I don't think horse race journalism should be the only kind of political journalism that is done in the campaign. It's just that a lot of people want that, which is not the media's fault.
Chris Siliza, writer and commentator, joins us in just a moment. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Celeste Headlee. So, in the interest of full disclosure, let me get this out of the way right at the top. I really hate horse race election coverage. I hate hearing constant polling numbers, questions about messaging instead of about policies. I hate that reporters care about likability. I find it irritating that coverage of Ron DeSantis talked about his plan to defeat Trump and rarely, if ever, mentioned that his positions on the issues were nearly identical to Trump's. And we should note, for those of you who are not super plugged in to the media and journalism discourse, I'm not alone. A lot of thinkers and advisory groups in our industry are moving away from horse race, and some outlets have vowed to make this change as well, moving toward less talk of who's winning, more talk of what's happening, less of is it popular, and more of is it good. So a defense of horse race journalism at this moment in time would be a relatively unpopular opinion. And luckily, that's what we have for you today. Chris Siliza is a commentator and writer, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Man, I am happy to be here, standing against the bulwark. Yes, I will. I want to make clear that while I am a believer generally in horse race journalism, what you just outlined is not at all an unfair critique, and I don't think it should be only horse race journalism. But we can get into it.
Well, let's start with, you know, most of the people listening are not journalists.
Yeah.
What's your definition of horse race journalism? What does horse race coverage mean?
Well, yes, great thing, I think, because a lot of people use it and don't. There's a lot of different definitions. Here's mine, and maybe it differs from yours, but mine is journalism that focuses on who's up and who's down. Literally a horse race. Like, this horse is ahead, this horse is in second, this horse is in third. Looks at heavy emphasis on polling, both of the horse race, the literal sort of, you know, Donald Trump is at 50, Ron DeSantis is at 20, Nikki Haley is at 8, as well as sort of the traits and attributes of the candidates. How are they connecting to voters? Are they connecting to voters? Are they good in debates? Are they effectively staying on message? Those, in a lot of ways, it's also described in a less pejorative way as sort of process political journalism, focused on the process of how these people run for office. I think horse race journalism has become, it wasn't when I started in journalism way back when, but it's definitely become a pejorative. I think those of us who seek to defend at least parts of it would prefer process journalism.
Yeah, and it's also been called strategic framing. Kathleen Hall Jamieson at the Annenberg Policy Center calls it tactical framing. So let's start there with this idea that it focuses on strategy. Mm-hmm. When we cover strategy, how someone plans to get votes, how they're earning money, etc., how is that serving voters? I mean, I know that we as political reporters are very interested mm-hmm. in that, but surveys show that the audience, the voters themselves, aren't that interested in it.
So here's what I would say. I guess I would disagree a little bit with that. I have sat in, you know, I worked at the Washington Post, at CNN, and at a smaller place early in my career called the Cook Political Report, which is a political handicapping service, a nonpartisan political handicapping service, which is the essence of horse race journalism, but that's a whole nother story. What I would say is that I've sat in lots and lots of focus groups over those times. Now, focus groups are not a poll, right? This is probably, for people unfamiliar with a focus group, this is probably, I mean, it depends, but 15-ish people. Usually they're, selected as a way to try to be representative of, you know, whether it's suburban Republicans or conservative Republicans or liberal Democrats or whatever. You know, they're selected as a group. And a pollster, sort of a professional pollster, runs them through a series of questions. Now, the weird thing about it is that people like me sometimes get to sit behind a wall where you can sort of hear, it's a one-way mirror where you can sort of watch them and how they respond to questions. You can read the transcript right afterward, but I always think it's helpful to watch them. And the thing that I keep coming back to is in all of those focus groups, there was very rarely, I wouldn't say never, because I think absolutes are ridiculous. There certainly were moments where people were very focused on a policy or two that a candidate had. But by and large, no matter what the question was, the answers were very personality focused. It was, I just don't like how he looks. He seems uncomfortable. My uncle sent me an email that says he's a bad guy. Like, it's very personality driven. And I think, again, I don't think horse race journalism should be the only kind of political journalism that is done in the campaign. That would be terrible. I think that there is a place for it, though, because I do think it reflects the fact that these are, at some level, particularly a presidential race, they are personality contests. Like, look, John Kerry was a decorated military veteran running in 2004 against a guy who had not served in George W. Bush and who had executed a war that most people didn't approve of. And yet George W. Bush wound up winning that. Like, if we just went by policies, if the way that people voted was go to one candidate's website, look at all the policy positions, put a check mark by the ones you agree with, then do the same with the other candidate, check mark, and then add up the check marks and just vote for the candidate who has more check marks, it would be a different thing. But in my experience, I have not seen that that's how voters make their minds up.
So, I mean, my first thing is I think that's a pretty self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that we as journalists began, we probably have a similar length of time in this business, right? I've been doing this for 25 years. Journalists began to cover personalities, especially when TV came into play with Nixon and Kennedy. And so that is what political coverage now is. I think it would be very difficult now to separate the voters' interest in personality and decide whether it was the chicken or the egg that really started that. The other thing I will say is that I actually agree that there's a place for horse race journalism, meaning I think there is a place for talking about polling, but it's tiny. And, you know, I'm looking at some of the studies of the past few elections and the percentage of news reports that covered the horse race in 2016 and then again in 2020 was nearly 45%. And policy stands was 10% or less. Leadership experience was 3%. So, I mean, the horse race is what we are covering, and it should not be dominating.
So I have a question. Can we take like a recent example? Because I know you're doing the interviewing. I just want to ask a question because I wonder if
go ahead.
I wonder if we'll agree or disagree. Joe Biden's age as a as a political issue.
Yes, I think we have drummed that up.
Okay. Did we, and by we, I mean sort of the royal we of the media, did we create that as an issue, or is that an issue that voters have that we cover? Maybe to your point, it may be a chicken and egg, and it's an unanswerable question, but I wonder what you think.
So I actually think that it was a talking point created by those in with the GOP and the conservative parties that we began quoting them on and interviewing them about, and it was repeated. And, you know, research into misinformation shows that when a false piece of information is repeated again and again, the chances that the listener will think that it's true mm-hmm. go up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we covered the political strategists and the commentators talking about his age, and that then it became an issue. Because, look, let's be honest. The fact of the matter is he's only a few years older than Donald Trump. If we're basing it on how many flubs he's made, you and I both know Joe Biden has been making flubs and gaffes in his speeches since for decades. And if you look at a transcript of Donald Trump's speeches, they're often incomprehensible.
I do that, and I agree with you.
Yeah. So the idea of Biden, you know, using the wrong word or calling someone the wrong name and that be an indicator of his age, that's pretty thin to me.
So I guess disagree is too strong a word. The only thing I would say is, like, the facts are this. Like, he's the oldest person ever to be elected
absolutely
president. He'd be 85 years old. He'd be the oldest person ever to run for a second term. By the way, you're exactly right. Donald Trump is not 45. Donald Trump is 77, right? So, like, it's not as though we're talking about Nikki Haley, even, who's, like, 52.
Yeah.
To me, if you, and again, this may be, you might say this is unimportant. When I watch Joe Biden move, talk, etc., it seems to me he has slowed down. I don't considerably, as such a subjective word. He has slowed down somewhat, even from when he first ran. So to me, it is visible that he is showing the signs of aging. So it does not, I don't think the media has created this, because to me, anyone who's paying any attention, and I know most voters don't pay a ton of attention, certainly not as much as you and I do, to what they do, what these politicians do on a daily basis, but to anyone with a set of eyes, it is clear that Joe Biden is elderly. And I think that raises the question, given the fact that he is 81, he will be 85 in 2029. You know, is this a job for someone that age? Now, I'm not saying that precludes that we have a conversation about Donald Trump, too. I'm just saying the idea.
Who is also elderly.
Right, who is 77. Absolutely. I'm just saying the idea that it's totally off. And this is the idea of the Biden White House, but it's totally a media creation. No regular person thinks that. Like, I think that is, and they told me I could swear on this, so I'll do a light swear. I think that is bullshit. Like, I just do not buy that. I do not buy that. The media did not create the fact that Joe Biden is 81 years old. They did not create the fact that he moves slowly. Look, if I'm vertical at 81, I will be thrilled, much less if I'm president of the United States. Like, I'm not taking anything away from him. But, like, I'm not running for president when I'm 81. Like, my mom is 76. She's wonderful. I love her. I don't want her to be president. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, look, Congress is a geriatric pool, right? Like, our government is elderly.
Yes.
And there is a lot of discussion, substantive discussion that could be made about that. But to me, this issue of his age is less important for us to cover than how has he done on the job? Not, is he visibly old? Yeah, you know, he's old. So's Donald Trump. They both gaff. Biden always has. Maybe Trump has. I haven't been covering him except for when he ran for president. So, you know, my memory isn't long. But there's a separate issue in terms of how old our government is, which is a real issue and a question, especially in light of some of the senators who've refused to retire, etc. And then there's the question of how does this matter when you're choosing a president? when you walk into that voting booth, it's our duty to make sure we have informed people what this person is going to do in office and how that's going to impact their lives. And his age is not really going to impact their lives all that much.
So, okay, so just two things, I think. One, I could argue, like, his age could very well impact their lives. Like, the actuarial table suggests men, white men in America live to 81 or 82 on average. So if he dies, I mean, I know people like talking about this, but like, if he does happen to die, it does happen, right? It's going to happen to all of us. Then someone else will be president. It will be Kamala Harris. Like, that is a thing that, while, of course, if you elect someone who's 45, they could totally go out and have a heart attack or get hit by a bus tomorrow, right? I mean, of course that is true. It is more likely that that happens when you're 81, 82, 83, 84, 85. That's my one point. So I do think it matters a little bit in that regard in terms of the choice. The other thing I would say is, like, I don't want to be a horse race absolutist in the sense that I think 100% or even 75% of the coverage should be horse race journalism. And honestly, like, a lot of the good journalism I see isn't. Like, you're talking about stakes and what they, you know, stakes versus odds and what they would do. Just as an example, I mean, I think the New York Times, you know, Maggie Haberman, John Swan, and Charlie Savage have done 4 or 5 pieces in the last couple months that are focused exclusively on this is what Donald Trump is saying, whether it's mass deportations, reinstating the Muslim ban, a purge of the civil service, rewarding schools that teach anti-woke policies. Like, to me, some of the criticism of the media, particularly from the left, is people who say, I can't believe no one would really support this sort of stuff. And therefore, if they were educated about it, they surely wouldn't vote for Donald Trump. To which I say, like, I actually think the media doesn't do a bad job of educating people, particularly about what Donald Trump thinks, says, and will do. It's just that a lot of people want that, which is not the media's fault.
We have to take a break here. I could not disagree more that we don't do a bad job, but we're going to get back to that in just a moment. We have to take a break. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
And we're back. I'm Celeste Headley. This is Hear Me Out. And today we're talking about horse race coverage with Chris Siliza, who says there is a place for horse race journalism, and me, who says no. No to the horse race. So let me start with, we just ended before the break with you saying you didn't think we've done a bad job. But by what measure? Because number one, I looked through a vast amount of analyses, including 2 meta-analyses of coverage from the major news organizations, not just the cable news, but also Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, NPR, etc. And most of these have been recent, these analyses. Most of them have been since 2015. But for example, one that looked at coverage from the second week of August in 2016 all the way up to Election Day found that the competitive game occupied 55% to 60% of coverage. Substantive concerns was only about 10%. Frankly, most of the analyses shows that by and large, horse race coverage dominates to a massive extent. And substantive issues, concerns, talking about the actual policies are dwarfed. In fact, that one that was looking at the months just before Election Day in 2016 found that while the competitive game was, you know, nearly 60%, campaign process took up the other third, so, which I would actually include in horse race coverage.
Right.
The other thing I will say is that we have also have, we can't pretend like we don't have the research on this. There was one meta-analysis of 32 studies going back to the 1990s that said, that found coverage of this type, in which we portray it as strategic, as winners and losers, leads to this perception among the people that politics is dominated by the motivation to get power rather than any substantive concerns for common good. I want to quote the scientist here, the lead scientist on this, because he said, horse race coverage inhibits the development of an informed citizenship because the public is mostly familiar with the political rivalries instead of actually knowing what the substantive debate is about. And when we test people about their knowledge of political topics, people don't know what's in the Green New Deal. There was a lot of coverage of the Green New Deal. Almost none of it was explaining what was inside it and whether experts thought that would actually work to address climate change. It was all about, did people like Representative Cortez, how Nancy Pelosi might deal with this, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think we're doing a good job. I don't think we're informing people.
Again, like I would be totally good with the horse race journalism being less than 50% of the overall coverage. Like, I'm not...
What percentage would like, you, could you 50, go down
50
to?
50-50 would be fine. 50-50-ish would be okay. I mean, I know we're not there yet. And I agree with you, by the way, about, like, to me, separating out, like, campaign journalism versus process, it's basically the same thing, right? I mean, it adds up to the same thing. It's two sides of the same coin. So I'm with you that we're not there yet. And I think the pendulum has at least begun to swing a little bit in favor or against sort of horse race journalism. And I don't know what the opposite of horse race journalism, but policy issue focused journalism. I would just suggest, and I don't know, I think we're just going to disagree about this. And maybe you have data because you definitely have more data than me. So maybe you have data on this. So if you do, I would love to hear it. But I would just suggest that the idea that people are yearning for, or even if they had, slews of policy coverage, that would be the way in which they would make decisions about president in particular. You know, we can debate House and Senate and governors, all this stuff, but they would make decisions about president. I just don't think is entirely borne out. I mean, you know, like, why did George Washington win? He was a war hero who was 6'2" and good looking and a good speaker. Like,
I mean, we've had almost no presidents who were under 6 feet tall.
There's a bias
toward tall people in society.
Yes, but that's the whole point. Like, if all we were focused on, if the media was to blame for the fact that people, you know, focused on height or looks, like, why has it always been true? The media has always done that, like, from
they kind of have.
I don't know. I just think there's a belief that people really want policy coverage. And I will tell you, I mean, I hate to talk about this side of the business, but look, the business side of media is tough. CNN laid me off. You know what I mean? It is a reality. And I think, now that we have all these tools to measure who's on what story, how, you know, what rated, what didn't rate, I will tell you, in my time at the Washington Post and at CNN, and again, you'll say this is a, I think you'll say this is a just a symptom, but the stories that did the poorest were oftentimes these deep dives into climate, for example, into immigration, like issues that are clearly of import to the country and its future. We couldn't get people to read them. Now, maybe they were, I guess they were poorly written. I mean, I don't think they were poorly written. I thought they were pretty captivating. But people kind of liked the story about, because it was easy, the story about 52 to 48. And that's a hard thing. And I don't know that that's the media's fault as much as it is human nature.
I mean, look, I am not blaming the hot mess that is our democracy on the media. There is a whole concatenation of circumstances bringing us to this moment when we're sort of teetering on the edge of losing it, right? You know, Ben Franklin famously said, we've got a republic, and if we can keep,
totally.
We can keep it, yep. We may not be able to keep
totally
it,
agree.
Right? I mean, that's the truth. On the other hand, let me give you some of the data.
Yes.
Here, because at one point there was an analysis of almost three dozen studies that involved nearly 39,000 to 40,000 voters. And they found that citizens give less positive evaluations to strategy-framed news stories. Those stories are considered to be biased than the issues-based stories. And people think horse race coverage is less credible, it's less interesting, and it's of low quality. Now, you're talking about layoffs. I truly believe that, you know, trust in our business is at an all-time low.
Mm-hmm.
People are choosing to stay away from news coverage, and the WHO has found that one of the reasons they choose to stay away from it is because it causes anxiety and literally causes depression and physiological mm-hmm. symptoms. I think that our insistence on framing everything as us versus them, which, yes, is going to draw eyes because that's almost tribal. It's almost evolution. It's tapping into an evolutionary impulse in us to think of ourselves in terms of those who are for us and those who are yep. against us. By the same token, though, it's not good for democracy. It's not doing our, in my case, public radio listeners a service. It's literally being recommended by doctors that they avoid it, and it's not leading to a more informed media. I mean, you're right. People have been talking about politicians in the U.S. at least, and describing their looks as long as we've had media and journalism in the United States. People often describe George Washington as tall, stately, muscular, handsome. On the other hand, I would say that our insistence on focusing on things like physical attractiveness and likability, we know through research, harms female candidates again and again and again and again. It harms candidates of color again and again and again. So, yeah, people may be noticing those things, but we don't have to report on them.
So, again, I don't disagree entirely with you. I really don't. I think you have, that's a very valid point, particularly about how it impacts candidates of color and women. The thing that I struggle with is the job of journalists to tell people what they should be interested in, or is it to report on what people tell them they should be interested in, or they are interested in, rather? You know, is the job of journalists to say, look, the world is getting warmer. We are having more unpredictable weather events, whether they be flash snowstorms or tsunamis, or, you know what I mean? And there's a clear reason behind this, and we know this is bad, and we can do something about it, and here are the things we can do. Is that the job of journalism, or is the job of journalism to say climate change is a massive problem and yet people remain blasé about it, you know? Or, like, I just don't know what the right way to cast journalism is, because I was always taught that the first one was activism. That, you know, it was activism to be like, here's what... I am smart. I know things. I went to, you know, wherever. I know that this is an issue and you need to care about it, as opposed to, well, what do you care about? And then let's write about that. Now, I think that that formulation has gotten more and more, I find it more and more difficult with Donald Trump in particular, right? Like, it's hard to just be like, on the one hand, the candidate is old. On the other hand, the candidate tried to overturn democracy. Like, you know, it's harder. I mean, I think that line between
activism, again, they're both old.
Right. That line between activism and journalism, to me, is much more blurry than it once was. And I'm 47. I think for people who are 27, they view it totally differently, which I understand. I'm just saying the way that I was taught was we cover what people tell us. We don't tell people.
So I'm so glad you've brought this up. This is a really incredible point that I want to talk about, but we do have to take a break first. So we will be back to talk about this. What is the point of journalism in just a moment? Stay with us. This is Hear Me Out. We're back. This is Hear Me Out, a podcast from Slate, and I'm Celeste Headlee, talking today with Chris Siliza about horse race coverage. But just before the break, you brought up a really, really important point, I think, Chris, which was whether journalists should be telling people what are the important issues or whether we should be taking our cues from our audience. And I
Yeah, you said it better than I did, but yes.
So this is the thing. We are always telling people what we think is important. I mean, there's no such thing as an unbiased journalist, because simply by choosing not only what to report on, but who to interview and how to put that person in context, how to put their remarks in context, which part of a speech to quote, we're making those subjective decisions all the time. And since we can't be objective, since that's impossible for Homo sapiens, I feel like we should own it. We should just be upfront with the fact that, look, we are human beings. We're making these decisions. We are professionals, but we're going to use transparency to fill in for the place where that pretend objectiveness used to be. I mean, objectiveness is not possible. So therefore, what we can do is say, this is why we chose this issue. Or we can put out questionnaires and let our audience vote on what they would like to hear more about. I mean, there are outlets that are experimenting with that right now, and none of them have heard from a majority of people saying they want to know more about the candidates' personalities. They're all about, what are they going to do on abortion? What are they going to do on the truck traffic in my neighborhood? I mean, you know, politics are always personal. People want to know how those policies are going to impact their lives.
So I agree with you on the objective thing. I do totally agree. I think that is a very, certainly a view I was, I mean, I was told very early on in my journalism career not to vote. Because that would suggest a subconscious finger on the scale, even if I did everything I could to be objective. So I agree with you. Look, I am a 47-year-old white male who grew up in Connecticut and went to prep school. That is not everyone's experience, man. Like, I get
it. You are central casting.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, yeah. I get it. So I think we have to be aware of that. At the same time, I don't think it is wrong to do what we can to represent all sides. So just, I'm very Trump focused. I just spent a lot of time thinking about him. So I think we spend a lot of time on what Donald Trump says and does. I think we could do more, for example, to talk about, like, who is it that, and I know liberals certainly hate this, but like, why do people support him? Like, is everyone who supports him an ignorant racist? Like, that seems to me an oversimplification and not part of our job as journalists. So like, I do think there are ways that we can try to use journalism to understand perspectives that are not our own. And I think that is of value, while acknowledging that, like, yes, of course you come to it and you're right. I mean, who I talked to was often determined by, particularly when I was a younger reporter, like, who came into the Panera and looked friendly so that I could talk to them. You know what I mean? Like, it was.
Yeah,
I was
absolutely.
Not, I was
I've
not
been
super
there.
Strategic about it. It was just kind of like, it's 11:30 a.m. in a Panera in Kentucky, and I need to, they told me I need to get
and
some
I have
voter
a deadline.
Voices.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But you're right. It's still, look, the kind of person who comes into a Panera at 11:30 in the suburbs, you know, is a different person.
And looks friendly to
totally
you.
Totally right. Totally right.
Yeah.
So I think I'd buy all of that. Can I make one? I just wanted to make one point. I want to make it earlier, but I do want to make it because you mentioned questionnaires that say people don't want more campaign journalism. So pornography. Just stick with me here. I will not work blue. This will wrap up relatively quickly, and I hope we'll make some sense. I feel like anytime you start with the word pornography, it could go in a lot of different directions. Okay. Pornography is a, I have not looked lately, but let's just call it a multi-billion dollar business, right?
Now, it's probably fair.
Right. Yeah. Multi-million, whatever. It's a very lucrative business, particularly on the internet.
Yeah.
Just, you know, the number doesn't really matter. Okay. If we had 100 people in a room and I said, who of you likes to look at pornography? Very few people, I think. I mean, maybe there would be someone would be like, totally. Like, they own it. It's cool. No big deal. But very few people, my guess would be like, I enjoy online pornography. And yet it's a, you know, multi-million or billion dollar industry. So to me, there's like a part of human nature that doesn't like, and yes, I am comparing campaign journalism to pornography here, which is not like a winner on my side, but
you said that
I
didn't
totally
say
right.
It. Yeah.
It's on me. I do think there is an element of people who want to feel like they are good government. I'm an intellectual. I only care about, you know, like where the candidate is down on policy. All this personality stuff is bullshit. And like, I don't care about. But when it gets down to rubber meets road, someone is putting all that money into the pornography industry. Someone is reading all of those articles on campaign journalism. Sorry, I'm banging my hands on the, it's not good for the audio engineer. Sorry. Like, there is, I think, an appetite for that. That is not one that we, Royal We Media, have created.
I mean, I love that you're banging on the desk because it's clear that you and I take this really seriously
and think about this a lot.
But I will also say that pornography is not the only industry that's specifically protected by the Constitution. Journalism is.
Yep.
We have a role in our democratic institutions. Like it or not, if you become a journalist and you're not part of a tabloid, you are in some way taking on that mantle of protector of democracy. So we're not supposed to be peddling pornography. We're supposed to be peddling things that lead to a more informed electorate, that lead to less cynicism in government because the government is how the democracy functions. That doesn't mean we can't fuel skepticism. I think skepticism is healthy. Cynicism is not. Cynicism, this belief that nobody is in it for everybody's out for themselves, that has shown to be associated with an erosion of the democratic processes. Skepticism, all for. And so when we do things like heavy coverage of polling, I mean, polling is especially bad because we know for sure that the majority of journalists who use polling data in their articles are misinterpreting what the statistics mean. Most journalists have not gotten any training in how to report on polling data. So they will report that someone is 3 points ahead and they're in the lead, when in fact the margin of error is 3 to 4 points and they're not in the lead. Yep. It's a dead heat.
Yep.
You know this.
Absolutely.
And so,
you are 1,000% right about that. There is no question. Like, I grew up working for Charlie Cook, the political handicapper. I grew up in journalism. So I like to think I have a pretty good understanding of polling, but you're exactly right. And I think,
but you're the exception.
Yes. And I think polling is particularly dangerous in that it is, it seems simple, but is actually quite complex, right? Like it seems like, oh, well, the numbers are the numbers. It's 52-48. It's like, I mean, sort of, but like anyone who knows anything about polling will tell you it's equal parts science and art, right? It's not just science. It's, well, how did they make, what does the sample look like? How did they come up with the sample? What weighting did they do after they did the sample? Like, it's complicated. And unfortunately, I totally agree with you. And by the way, we have seen in the last 10 to 15 years, a flood of pollsters with no real record of, I mean, success or failure, no real record.
Yeah.
Flooding the zone. And guess what? The worst polls are usually the cheapest. And unfortunately, because news media organizations are often looking for the cheapest, that's what they take, because it produces a number and the number produces a headline. So, like, I'm with you on that. I think the way in which polling has been reported and then is weaponized by both sides is a hugely problematic. Yes, I couldn't agree more. And when I try to do it, I really try to always put in, I try to never write just about one poll, first of all. Because one poll is poll, right? Like, I mean, it could be right, but there's also, any pollster will tell you, you know, there's a non-zero chance it's wrong. Like, just totally wrong. Yeah. And I always try to say, even though I don't think people hear it, like, any poll or even a series of polls is a snapshot in time. It is not representative of anything other than the sample. What you put in often dictates what you get out. Just like gas. You put crappy gas in the car, you put diesel in a car that doesn't get diesel, you get crappy results. You put good gas, get better results. So yes, I agree. I actually think media organizations should force journalists to take a class on
totally agree.
Polling. And by the way, I think journalists should be forced to take a bunch of classes on how a lot of this stuff works, because so much of it, I mean, I know I learned it this way. You just kind of learn by doing, you know. It's kind of like, I remember being, you didn't ask this, but I remember being, I'm sure you have the same experience. Well, maybe you don't. I did. I'd be on the phone with sources and they'd be like, yeah, our GOTV efforts are really good. We're doing this, this, and that. And I'd be Googling GOTV because I didn't know it stood for get out the vote. Like, I just was, you know, like, and
yeah.
So I do think there is an education effort that political journalists would benefit from. I think other journalists do, right? If you cover national security, I think there's sort of a bar of knowledge you meet. I think if you cover the environment, energy, I think with political journalism, it's a pretty low bar for entry. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't do this education that they should to make it so that you're telling people, to your point, you're not saying it's a lead when it's not.
Right. So we're coming to the end here. And I feel like, I've loved this conversation. I have.
Oh, okay, good. I don't want you to hate me.
Why would I hate you? We literally invited you here to disagree with me. And that's what you've done. And that's what we wanted you to do.
One thing I do want to say is, like, this is something that I have, and I think any serious political journalist grapples with. Or journalism is great. It serves everyone. It's perfect. Everything we've ever done is perfect. Like, no, we in the media make tons of mistakes. I personally have made a bunch of mistakes. I've been wrong about stuff. I have been misguided about stuff. I try to your transparency point, I try to always own up and be like, here's how I got to this point. Here's why I screwed up. And here's why I'm going to try not to let it happen again. But again, like, it is something that I grapple with almost on a daily basis when it comes to, like, what do you write and why?
So, look, it's more important than ever that we hear from you on this. You, our audience, do you want to hear more about personalities, campaign strategies, fundraising by candidates? Or would you like to hear more about specific policy proposals from candidates and whether those are good, meaning effective, or not? We want to hear what you think about horse race coverage and whether it's good or bad. Our email address is hearmeout@slate.com. We know you have thoughts to share. Please keep them coming. Hear Me Out is a podcast from Slate. The show is produced by the very likable Maura Curry. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations and also leading in the polls. Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Slate Audio, and darn it if she's not absolutely showing leadership qualities every day. I'm your host, Celeste Headley. Until next time, speak your mind, but keep it open.